ideas, training data, including art, what if that's a good thing? What if we turn the production of training data into a new art form?
Hello, and welcome to the Culture and Technology Podcast, brought to you by the Vienna Business Agency. My name is Severin Matusek, and today's guest is Eva Jaeger. This is the first episode of season 5 of this podcast, and I couldn't be more excited to kick it off with Eva. Eva is a curator, designer, and researcher based in London. As the curator of arts technologies and creative AI lead at Serpentine, she's one of the masterminds behind The Call, the first solo exhibition by artists Holly Herndon and Matt Dryhurst, in which they showcase and explore the creative processes, limits, and limitlessness of creating a generative AI model. To me, The Call is many things: a pioneering artwork, an AI model, a sonic exploration of choral music across the UK, and an experiment, first and foremost, that poses some of the central questions of generative AI today. How do artists work with AI in a meaningful way? Why is the creation of an AI model as important as its output? Who owns the data it's trained on and the music it creates? And what is art in the age of AI? So, how was The Call made? I wanted to peel off all the layers that made this exhibition so unique and insightful. So I met Eva at Serpentine North in London to find out.
The Call is, to me, a wrapper for a kind of dream project that could have only happened with the artists Holly Herndon and Matt Dryhurst and the incredible team that I work in at Serpentine Arts Technologies. And it happened at a perfect moment in history where people were really looking to the art world to answer this question: what does it mean to be an artist in the age of AI? What does it mean when, as Matt and Holly say, all media is training data? And we were able to spend about 18 months unpacking that question and figuring out how to present a new way of art making to the public. And we did it through so many different vectors. We thought about the exhibition format. We thought about the production of training data and the kind of new performance gestures that that allows for. We thought about the new kind of creative production that has to happen, in this case, the production of a songbook that's written specifically for AI training. And then we had to really think about what infrastructure exists for protecting the choir members whose precious voices would be used to train these AI models. And that's where the work of Future Art Ecosystems, which you know really well, which is our kind of R&D arm of the work that we do, could come into play and could offer some kind of prototype for working with content producers in a way that's actually empowering to them. So I know I explain this in a really abstract way, but I think it's just to say how major I feel this project is in terms of hitting on all of these different things. And yes, it's an exhibition, but I think it's more that we use The Call to carve out space to work on each of these things.
You just took us through the exhibition here at Serpentine North in London. And I think the one thing that became so immediate to me in being in the exhibition is that it's so multi-layered, that there are so many things going on, from the way it is being designed to the sound that you hear, to the text that you read, to the 3D carved structures, to the symbols from ancient times. So I would really love to use this conversation as a way to unpack each layer bit by bit. You mentioned that you worked on it for 18 months. So can you tell us a little bit about how the project started? Where did the idea come from? How was the initial first few months of working with Holly Herndon and Matt Dryhurst on the conceptual approach to it?
Yeah, so my colleagues Kay Watson and Victoria Nivanova and I were in the process of researching this public AI project that we published in March. And so we were having a lot of kind of conversations about AI and creative production. And Matt and Holly were such great thought partners on that. And they've been conversation partners for us for so long. And then we started to imagine what it would be like to present their work to the public and to present something completely new. Now, I think that most people do see their practice as musicians. That's their biggest audience, I would say. But obviously, more recently, their work has been very visual, the sort of outputs of generative models. I was noticing that something was getting slightly lost, that people were seeing the final outputs as the artwork, when I felt that actually the groundbreaking work that they were doing was one step before that, the level of creating the models. And then also, of course, they have a practice of these training performances that they did during the times of creating their albums. I felt like actually these things are very connected, the production of training data as part of releasing an album, as part of the performance of an album, and then also the creation of a generative visual model. And of course, they were doing all this work with spawning. And so it felt like, okay, we can also really trial something that's about governance, public governance.
So maybe just because some of the listeners might not know Holly Hearn and Matt Trahalst, my perception of them is that they're a very unique artistic duo that come from music and the arts, mm-hmm. but have been occupied with AI for a very long time. And exactly as you said, don't just think of the creative opportunities that new technologies give them, but think very deeply about how these technologies can be used for artists to have agency, to participate, to, is that correct? How would you describe their work beyond the call or before the call?
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty bang on. What's interesting about them is that they think about what it means to be an artist right now at all times. So 10 years ago, they were thinking about what it means to be an artist making videos online that are competing with Beyoncé videos, or what does it mean that an album has turned into a playlist, has turned it, you know, they're really thinking about what is cultural production and where does the artist sit. So it's no different with AI. And I think in producing the book that we've made that sits alongside of this exhibition, Matt was saying, yeah, I wasn't really that interested in AI until I started being able to play around with it myself, like 2015, started to understand how images were being generated, how sound was being generated. They get really close to the metal when they work, and that's how they discover things. So for instance, Matt and Holly are really well known for a project called Holly Plus, and it's a synthetic version of Holly's voice. During the process of, you know, working with engineers to do this, they realized that they had to come up with the training data. So they used Holly's voice, but they needed more. And instead of scraping that content, they formed an ensemble. And so they come to these realizations through the making of something, through trying to produce something. Another thing that I love about their practice is that they often take something which is the worst case scenario and turn it on its head. So in the case of Holly Plus, what's the worst thing that every artist is afraid of, that someone could copy them, that someone could produce their voice, use it on their album without their consent. And instead, they came up with this tool that does exactly that. And then they think about how could Holly and Matt participate in having some consent over that, having some veto power, and actually financially gaining from that transaction as well. In this case, they thought about, you know, what does it mean? The worst case scenario, all media is training data, including art, and said, what if that's a good thing? What if we turn the production of training data into a new art form? I just feel that that's like a very hopeful approach that we all need to take on. We are like desperate for it, you know? Mm. And I feel like we all went into this with this kind of fierce positivity of being like, yeah, we were not happy with it how it is now, but that doesn't mean we don't engage with the technology. And the further along in the process we get, the more solutions we'll find. Mm.
So going back to the beginning of the call 18 months ago, the image I get now is that you Eva, Kay, Victoria, the Future Art Ecosystems team at Serpentine were thinking about how can we respond to this drastic changes in the production of art and media through AI and create something meaningful here. And then on the other side, you knew each other before, obviously. Holly Hunt and Matt Tryhurst have been working on these topics for such a long time. So it feels like this match made in heaven of the two parties coming together to think about what can we do that's really meaningful.
Exactly. I thought a lot about how to get to the core of their practice. The art world moves kind of slowly, and it's okay to present their practices light years ahead of where a lot of people's minds are thinking about these kinds of things. And I felt like if we can get to the core of these ideas within their practice that I just described, if we can surface that for people in this really clean, kind of singular idea, that's, let's say, the core of the onion, because there are so many layers, then we can build on top of that. But we need to have a kind of North Star. And that came from a video that they showed us of someone using Holly Plus, but I can't quite remember. It was harmonized or something, but it was a singer using a microphone and then hearing back their voice harmonized through the Holly Plus synthesizer. And I thought, this is that moment where you're going to reach beyond the cognitive and feel something so emotional. And so that's where this idea of what would it mean to produce a choral AI model collectively, beautifully, and the idea of creating this kind of liturgical environment that thinks about technical protocols as new rituals, and the sound of the choir, all of the metaphors that we can create around collectivity and collective intelligence with the choir, that they all kind of spilled from that.
One thing that also struck me in the exhibition was that the way you introduce the exhibition to the visitor is that you present AI as a collaborative technology. And to me, that felt like this is not the usual way AI is being talked about. And then, of course, in connection with choirs and singing and call and response as cultural techniques that have been around for so many centuries. And why did you choose to describe AI as a collaborative technology?
Yeah, I think we do, but we do two things. We describe it as collaborative and also as a coordination technology. The collaborative notion comes from the fact that all the training data that generative AI models, which I would say are the ones most people are talking about these days, they're drawn from the internet, from mass swaths of data, libraries, etc., that are our human production, whether that's code, literary work, paintings, recipes, whatever. And so in that sense, it is extremely collaborative. When you write into ChatGPT and it gives you something back, it's not some alien response, although maybe the logic system is alien to us. The content that it's putting back at you is very, very human. And it's this idea of that Matt and Holly talk a lot about, of emergence. So when a choir sings, it has certain polyphonic emergent properties. And that's also true about data sets. So when you put lots of data together and run it through these models, certain patterns surface. And those patterns, which are insights or new directions or whatever, are coming from all of the collective data. We can get into that later when we talk about the data trust experiment, just because it's really saying data is not individual, it's relational. It's stronger when it's in relation to other pieces of data.
Mm-hmm. So we're now in the middle of the conception of this exhibition, you and Matt and Holly coming together, conceiving the idea, the core of the onion, as you said, and then building these different layers around it. So where are we now? Now that the idea is there, is the next layer the creation of the data, which is the choirs that you recorded across the UK, or is it the AI model that you created for it? Where are we right now in the process?
Yeah, exactly. So to make the choral AI models, we had to collect data. What we did was we planned a tour around the UK to mostly community, a couple professional choirs. And we did that by putting out a call. Matt and Holly did this through their social media, and then we did it through various choral newsletters. And for those of your listeners who are inquirers, they will know that the community is very tight-knit community, and they all know each other and talk to each other. So that was an incredible experience. Our arts technology producer, Ruth Waters, she had to form really intimate relationships with the choir directors who don't all use email necessarily. There was a lot of phone calls and chit chats and coffees and trying to explain the idea of this project to people who really, they just want to get together and sing. So they had to have an open mind both about singing new hymns that Matt and Holly had written and also participating in the kind of experiment around how they were going to govern their data. Even the idea of calling it data, that was a kind of huge bridge to cross, because for them, their performances or recordings of them singing together.
So did you encounter a certain fear, anxiety of these choir leaders and the choirs themselves of working with AI or of producing data?
Yeah, I think there were choirs who were reluctant or ones who didn't even want to participate. But once we formed those relationships, I think that people were really curious. They know that AI is something that they're reading about all the time. It's something that they need to get, you know, familiar with, and that maybe through their hobby, that would be an interesting way to learn more. And we were very transparent all the time about what we knew, what we didn't know. Yeah, at the end of it, no one withdrew their recording. So I think that's a testament.
And after these initial conversations and coffee dates, you went almost on a tour. You toured through the UK and recorded 15 choirs across the UK. Was it literally a tour that you went from one stop to another?
Yes.
In a week or so, yeah?
Yeah, no, it was about 4-5 weeks, I think, like technically 6. Yeah, Ruth Waters, Ben Metzers, and I, and Matt and Holly, and Link, and actually Holly's mom.
And Link is their son.
Their son, yes. Packed up 2 cars and all of the equipment and went on the road.
Amazing.
And that was a really fun experience. Also just designing this whole recording protocol, thinking about what was the best kind of mic to future-proof the data set. Right now, we have a lot of data that's scraped off the internet. It's stereo data. It's not necessarily going to be as useful as something like ambisonic, a recording of a choir, which is what we ended up doing, which captures this kind of 360 impression of the choir. So not only the individual voices, but also the space itself. It was such an adventure because at each location, we weren't exactly sure what we were going to rock up to. We had to put a lot of trust in the choirs to make sure that everyone had rehearsed their voice parts and that they were, yeah, being open to the experimental nature of the music. So the way that Holly and Matt wrote the music, there was a lot of room for interpretation. And even though Holly did sessions with the choir directors and even in some cases listened to recordings from them, she really wanted them to feel that they could play with the music and interpret it the way that really suited them. And so you'll hear in the exhibition how one choir after another singing the same song sounds very, very different. Mm.
So all the choirs sang the same song or the same set of songs, and that became the training data.
Yeah, so I forgot to mention the songbook, which was a whole nother kind of work in and of itself. Holly and Matt collaborated with a lab in France called Algamus, and they use procedural generation, which is old-fashioned kind of AI, not deep learning, to generate new music based on a training data set. And in this case, they used Sacred Harp, which is, if you listen back to Matt and Holly's albums, a real source of inspiration for them over the last 10 years, I would say. And the Sacred Harp music was then generated, and Holly worked with her composer's assistant to arrange the music, and then Matt and Holly wrote all the lyrics together. And the lyrics are actually formulated in such a way that they have each phoneme of the English language. So there's a lot of decisions, compositional decisions, that went into the designing of the book itself, so that it's really a useful resource for a machine learning model to train on. So you have the whole range of the English language, you have quite a range of voice parts. And then there was the added challenge of making music that was accessible enough for the community choirs that we worked with so that they could spend a couple hours practicing the music and successfully sing it. Yeah.
So you created a songbook. You went, or Matt and Holly created a songbook. You went on tour for 5 to 6 weeks. You recorded the data. Now you return home with this rich data set. What happens now?
So Matt and Holly spent a lot of time just listening through all of the music to figure out what is this data set, what's good in this data set. And I think that is an incredibly creative part of the whole process, where because of their expertise and experience, they are really able to figure out what to pull from it and what to leave out. There's also the cleaning process, and we worked with a really great engineer who's a music assistant for Holly. And he spent hours and hours and hours. I mean, I can't understate the labor that's required to clean and organize and tag and label this data, and how many creative decisions are part of that process.
There's a lot of conversation within the field of AI about AI biases and the decisions and values and ideas about the world that go into AI models. So can we say that already at this stage of just cleaning up the data, these decisions matter, and the audio engineer who worked on it had probably also had a lot of conversations with the artists to make the right decisions, because this will significantly influence the output of the model, right?
Yeah, certainly. I think this might be controversial, but bias is always seen as a bad thing when in these kind of ML conversations. But actually, in this case, we wanted the model to be biased. We wanted it to be trained on these particular voices and the way that these particular choirs coordinate, even their accents, for instance. We wanted it to be biased. We weren't trying to make a general model that sounds like general mid choirs. So I actually think of that in the context, at least, of creative production as a feature of the process. Yeah.
The data is being cleaned, and then it's there. It's clean. It's beautiful. Lots of decisions already went into it. What happens now?
So this is where a couple different things happen. There's sort of two pipelines for making the models. One, which is the real-time model you got to experience by singing through the microphone. We worked with EarCam, who are electronic music research lab associated with Pompidou. And Holly's been working with their tools for a really long time, and she happened to be doing a residency there that kind of was able to be configured as part of the project with Serpentine. And she asked them, can you make a real-time model that's able to turn my singular singing voice into a choral voice? And that was the brief to them. And that took many, many months of finding solutions and working back and forth. At one point, Holly said to me, it's not sounding good enough. Ian, the person I mentioned who's doing the data cleaning, he had to do a whole scrub of the data to get better output. So it's a really iterative back and forth process, and a process that I can see Holly really loves, this problem solving and working with technical engineers. And then on the other side, there was the project of working with Stable Audio's research grade model with some people that Matt and Holly have been working with for a really long time. And they were basically fine-tuning the Stable Audio model on the outputs from the choirs and just seeing what was coming back. And that was a very exciting point quite late in the exhibition making process, where they were sending through these 3-minute songs and they were just incredible. I remember talking in one of our weekly meetings, we were just like, this changes everything because it's able to produce one after the next. Matt was saying, this is the end of a single albums. Like, we're going to have to start releasing our albums as models that people can prompt into.
Wow. So if I understand correctly, you then trained two models. You said the one model is the live model, which we saw in the exhibition before. There's a microphone stand in the middle of the room. You can go there and sing and you hear something back, which is the output of the model. And then the other one, you called it a stable audio model. And that's essentially the main AI model that is trained on these data sets and that creates entire songs based on which input?
Yeah, so the Stable Audio, it's a kind of foundational audio model created by Stability. And then what Matt and Holly did with these engineers is create fine-tuned models on top of that foundational model. So this is two really different ways of working. They produce quite different things. The Stable Audio model, it already has all of the knowledge of what a song is, what a pop song is. So you can ask it more, you can ask it to relate to culture in a different way than the real-time model, which is just receiving your audio as input. Mm-hmm.
But so the Stable model, can I imagine it similar to ChatGPT? There's an interface and I can type in, give me a song that's 3 minutes long with lyrics talking about plants and bees in that tonality, and then puts out that song.
Yeah, and also with the fine-tuned model, you can call, so we talked about tagging data, so you can call in specific things that you tagged in your data set. That's where I was saying these decisions are quite consequential. What the artists deem as haunting or beautiful or feminine or whatever, those are things they can then call back from their model. Or a specific song that the choir is saying linked, they could call that in one of the prompts.
So that's where the analogy to call and response comes back. So call and response being a very foundational technique in singing is now finding its way into an AI model, that there's an AI model and I call it and the AI model responds to me.
Yeah, the call and response metaphor just keeps giving.
Okay. So we're now at a point where this whole work gets into how do we translate all of that into an exhibition that people can actually perceive. And walking into Serpentine, you are greeted by this huge altar that speaks to you, that you know has sound, that is made of those thousands or hundreds of computer fans, which you told me is a little subculture that already existed where people make music out of these fans. So at this stage, you work with an architecture studio all throughout the whole process. How can we imagine the process of putting all of that model that actually exists on screens and in computer processing ways into something physical, something people can actually experience?
The thing that was really important to all of us was that as complex and rigorous as I think the work that went into the show is, we really wanted for someone to come in and have a completely experiential moment where they didn't need to understand anything or read anything, that you could just come in and listen to the sounds, be guided by the sound, and that there is something intuitive about the show. And should you want to read more about it, there are endless layers. So that was kind of our first brief to ourselves, that this should be an awe-inspiring moment where people start to think of the creative potential of these tools and they don't have some curatorial text jammed down their throat when they first get in. That it's first about kind of meeting the space, which I think is quite calm. We use a lot of the tropes that you find in religious environments where you have this instant feeling of being part of something that's bigger than yourself.
So the brief to the architecture studio was, did you give them some input of medieval environments, choirs, but at the same time, hyper-modern processing units of computers, and then they created these altars and these installations out of it?
Yeah, I can't overstate how much of this experience was a kind of iterative process where in our little insular bubble, we were creating a logic system that really made sense, like a kind of lens on everything. And then we would push ideas through it. And that included the architecture firm Sub that we worked with. They included in that bubble. And so there were never moments where we decided for something to become post-World War I Italian, church embossing and gilding. It was more that one decision led to a next, to the next, and we had to trust that process. And so the kind of insane aesthetics that you encounter in the show are really the product of a lot of micro decisions. And in many ways, we all had to step back at the end and look at what was created. And just feel like, wow, how did we get here? To me, these objects are very post-generative AI. Mm-hmm. They have a kind of drawing from the past, kitsch, aesthetic, and I mean that really in the best way, where you recognize everything, but in the configuration that they look quite strange or surreal. And that, to me, is the visual landscape that generative AI also produces.
You mentioned several times already the words protocol and rituals. Mm-hmm. And I'm really interested in your perspective on it, because I keep seeing the resurgence of these words that a few years ago were mostly related to ancient practices, like a ritual in, I don't know, ancient religions of people surrounding around the fire or something like that. And now, of course, with blockchains and new technologies, the idea of the protocol became very prevalent again. Do you see a connection between cultural pre-digital practices that were called something like ritual or protocol and hyper-digital virtual elements that are also called protocol? Like, where's the connection?
Yeah, exactly as you described it. I think that connection is super important. In the book, actually, Primavera De Filippi, she writes a piece which came from a conversation with Matt and Holly, and she basically lays out the idea of protocol art and references Solowid and these kinds of artists who they were always thinking about putting forward a framework that involves some kind of participation from the executor of the protocol so that they become implicated in the creative act. So whatever is produced is the product both of the protocol maker and the person executing the protocol. And I think that tracks with the way that Matt and Holly think about the kind of future of production and consumption when it comes to interacting with AI models. They need users. They need people to use them, to jailbreak them, to experiment with them, to prompt them. And so creation moving forward will always be that kind of collaborative protocol type art, whatever name that you give to it.
So going back to the exhibition, the way a visitor in the exhibition, or let's call them even users, they enter the exhibition, they are invited to participate, and the formats of participation are almost predetermined by the protocol that was created by the artists, right? So there is a framework. Can you tell about how visitors can participate and what happens within the AI model then?
So visitors can participate in the oratory, which is these sort of two small private spaces within the exhibition. And people go in and they can use the microphone to sing and use this real-time choral AI model. We've had all different kinds of trials. People have brought instruments, they play sound from their phone, they sing in groups, they sing by themselves. But I think this is the way that people actually interact with these technologies. And so it was really important that we include a moment for that collapse of production and consumption.
And zooming out from the exhibition, if you say that maybe the future role of the artists, at least artists that work with AI technologies, is not to just use the technologies, but also create and feed them and produce the data and think about the rules and the protocols under which it functions. And then having the users participate in that to contribute even more data. That's where I think now the data trust experiment comes in, because my understanding of it is that it's a framework and a model that thinks of certain layers of participation and production of data in a fair way, that the user or the producer somehow participates in the way value is created out of that data or out of the content that is being created, which often is not the case in most AI models, because there's usually big corporations behind them. And as a user, you merely participate by getting something out of it, but often your data is being used without your consent, without any participation. So that's just my framework of how I understood the data trust experiment, but I would love to hear your thoughts about it.
Yeah, sure. So one thing is just to say that when people are singing in the exhibition, we're not recording their voices.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that was a really intentional decision, because the data trust experiment is something where we require a lot of trust from the choristers, and we wanted to keep that a closed environment and for the experiment to have integrity. And this is where, the work of Future Art Ecosystems comes in, and my partner in crime on that, Victoria Ivanova, who led the data trust experiment. So essentially what we did is to say, okay, we're in the process of collecting all of this data or recordings from choirs. Is there an opportunity to use this really fast production process to actually test some of the theoretical frameworks that currently exist around the content creators of training data, having some say in how their data is used, whether or not it's used, etc.? So we did a couple different things. First, we just did a landscape review of what's on the scene? What are people working on? And of course, our kind of collaborators and partners, people like Matt Pruitt at Radical Exchange and Sylvie Delacroix at the Center for Data Futures, were really helpful in pointing us in the right direction. So we were looking at a framework called bottom-up data trusts. Basically, it addresses the issue that at the moment, GDPR and IP and all of these kinds of legal frameworks that exist to protect our data are very individualized. But data is only valuable to AI models in aggregate and in relation to other data. So if we really want to get past the kind of opt-in, opt-out, really laborious and individual way of interacting with data politics, we need a whole other layer of infrastructure. And I just say that very abstract word because we don't quite know exactly what those things will be yet. We need a layer of infrastructure that collectivizes data and can make decisions in the collective and bargain on behalf of collectives. So what the bottom-up data trusts proposes is that you actually involve the people whose data you're using in decisions about how they want to be governed. And then once you have a governing structure on how the data should be used. So if you think about all the different parts of a AI pipeline, you have the data that's being used. So the recordings get recorded, then they get turned into a data set, they get turned into a model, and then someone prompts the model and new output comes out. We don't have a lot of legal frameworks to decide who is going to own the output of that model. Right now, it's just basically in the public domain. We don't have any real firm laws around who owns a model. But we do have some laws around data sets and databases, and we do have laws around your individual voice or your recordings. Mm. So we figured out how we could actually leverage those existing rights and make some kind of speculative arguments as well on the model. But I think the biggest innovation that happened, besides the fact that we actually worked with 400 people to make these decisions, which was a kind of incredible feat. And that
the 400 people are
the choir members.
The choir members, yeah.
And that we hired what is apparently one of the first data trustees, Jennifer Ding, to kind of manage the relationship with the choirs and help them understand
what their data was being used for and be a liaison that was really working on their behalf in interacting with Serpentine and the artists. And what we ended up coming to in this whole process is a situation where Serpentine is a steward of this data set. So we have a code of conduct that's been agreed by the choir members, and Serpentine can sublicense that data set. So it proposes a new framework where cultural institutions become stewards of valuable data sets and are able to collectivize those assets or collectivize those rights, depending on what the content of the data set is. But I think, yeah, it's quite abstract and speculative and nerdy. I get that. But on the other hand, I feel proud that we actually did a real experiment in this, and that we could work with Matt and Holly to actually instrumentalize this exhibition towards something which is actually pretty groundbreaking. Mm-hmm.
This leads us to the final thing I would like to discuss, which is future art ecosystems. So you mentioned Data Trust Experiment came out of Future Art Ecosystems, which is this R&D arm of Serpentine that has existed for several years already. I think you had your 10-year anniversary recently. And you mentioned the role of cultural institutions in this developing landscape of AI and new technologies. So how would you describe the relevance of something like future art ecosystems, not just for a gallery like Serpentine, but the broader landscape of museums, institutions, galleries?
Yeah, I think the main thing that we're trying to do with future art ecosystems is to say, what is art and tech work for? We work in this niche of art and technology, and it comes with its own baggage, and we're asking, why do we work on this? What do we think this art can do? And we have some proposals that it can actually do a lot more than be part of just a contemporary art canon, that it can actually be a place of experimentation, but it needs the right infrastructure in order to do that. So I think these speculative ideas that exist in academia around the data trust and that we proposed could be used by cultural institutions, that's fine and well in theory, but the process of going through a year of actually doing it in this kind of rapid, creative, excited and naive way was able to produce so much knowledge for the kind of governance and data world, for the museum world. And we just see again and again that the way that we're able to produce working with new technologies in this creative way is, it's really fruitful.
Mm. So going full circle back to Matt and Holly, their conviction being, as artists, we have to have a deep understanding of these technologies in order to create something meaningful and have agency in the creation. Is there a parallel to future art ecosystems and cultural institutions that often we see cultural institutions being too slow or being too passive in order to really respond to these new challenges, and then often becoming kind of like the tail end of just not having a real agency or ownership in these processes, that you want to flip it around, that you see the potential of cultural institutions of playing an active and important role in shaping technologies and whatever comes out of it?
Yeah, well, I work at one, so of course that's my position. No, I mean, I think that in general, institutions are really not able to see where art is happening, especially when it comes to this art and tech niche. That's for a number of reasons. But in general, what they make in terms of keeping up with new technologies is reactive in response. It's for a financial partnership. It's done for all the wrong reasons. And with Future Art Ecosystems, we propose that art and tech organizations, they have to have certain missions, the kind of research they do, the kind of prototypes that they make. As long as they're mission aligned, that's the way to safeguard them to be productive. So I kind of lost the plot of your question, but in general, yes.
Yeah, how cultural institutions can have more leverage and agency in the development of new technologies, essentially, and future art ecosystems being an answer to that, potentially.
I've been attending a lot of kind of roundtables. Everyone wants to have a roundtable on AI and creativity, AI and the art sector, and the conversation, in my opinion, is way too broad. Mm-hmm. It talks about AI the same way. It might as well be for social media or for the internet. And one thing we try to do with this future art ecosystems, art and public AI publication, is to actually break down AI into its different sort of tech stack layers and to address the artist, the organization, and the ecosystem across each of those layers. And that's why the book is so thick. Because
mm-hmm. It is thick. Yeah, it's the biggest one so far. It's the fourth one.
Yeah.
And it's very thick.
On page 33, we break it down. Each of these layers, it has its own politics. And it's absurd to imagine that an artist can take on AI or that an institution can take on AI. We just have to have a more nuanced, realistic approach to where our intervention is. With this data trust project, we're just taking on the data layer in the software stack, and we're making one small gesture instead of sort of frantically running around and claiming big things about AI.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for being with us and sharing all your very interesting thoughts.
Oh, thank you. I hope I didn't bore you with too much talk of data infrastructure.
This was Eva Jaeger in a conversation recorded in November 2024. The call is still on view at Serpent & North until February 2025. And if you missed it, I can recommend reading the accompanying publication, All Media is Draining Data, published by Walter Koenig Books. And if you like AI or don't like AI, I also recommend listening to my conversation with James Spreidel in episode 19 of this podcast. This is the Culture and Technology Podcast, produced by the Vienna Business Agency. The Vienna Business Agency supports new companies, projects, and products that develop Vienna's creative industries further.